London is filled with little cul-de-sacs of history. Forgotten moments that their memory is overwhelmed by the passing of time. Tiny fragments of the past, seemingly lost from the story until you dig for them. Let's give a great example. Round about 1428, a leading English bishop based in Southwark raised thousands of men to march off on an unexpected crusade on the other side of Europe, and did indeed raise those thousands of crusaders to do so, only they never quite made it. This force, raised by the most powerful man in South London, ended up fighting a mad teenage girl who was leading her own vision of a crusade. This is a chapter about London during an explosion of faith. Only it wasn't exactly an explosion. Faith, fervent and ecstatic belief in God, was powerful enough to cause men to be willing to die for it and to be willing to kill for it, and had long been a feature of its life. But in the early part of the 15th century, the continent of Christendom was convulsed by a new wave of these religious passions. We'd just seen the depths of how big these passions could get with the Lollards of England. But this was nothing to what was going on in Europe. Over there, we'd just seen three popes all existing all at the same time. We have heretics over in Europe inspired by the Lollards, taking large parts of Europe and by accident making significant contributions to modern warfare. And as I said, you've got a teenage girl claiming to her visions of the Archangel Michael and somehow becoming the most iconic warrior of her era. Religion was political and all politics was religious. And it was around this that London is trying to cope and endure. And the next few years reveal a city probably watching open-mouthed as religious passions mixed with power politics. Hi there, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the chronological events of this city from beginning to end, each chapter taking us a little bit along the grand narrative of this tale. My aim is to be as historically accurate as possible, while at the same time trying to present the events in a story format. Now, we have reached the years round about 1426 or so until 1430. And it was a period filled with pageantry, building, politics, and more. Welcome then to the 154th chapter of this story of London, a sudden crusade in Southwark. This week is about Southwark, but as I've said, it's also about events elsewhere, crazy and wild events. Because there's a lot of crazy stuff about to happen right across Europe over this period, and London was never more than 3 degrees of separation from any of it. But since this chapter is named after Southwark, we're going to start there. And we're going to start with a wedding. But to understand how significant this wedding is going to be in the future of the story of London, we need to explain the context of this wedding. And for that, we need to go back just a few years to round about the year 1406. See, back then there was some intense civil war type things going on up in Scotland, and for safety, the young heir to the Scottish throne, a child called James, was put on a boat and sent to France for safekeeping. Only back in 1406, Scottish and English ships were widely engaged in piracy against one another due to Scotland's siding with the French during the ongoing English and French War. And in March that year, the French ship Prince James was on was captured by an English ship. And the young 11-year-old heir to the Scottish throne was handed to the King of England and remained in captivity for the next 18 years. As the uncrowned King of Scotland, James I, as he was known, was an important hostage for the English kings, Henry IV and Henry V. Nominally, he was worth a lot of money. I say nominally, as back north, and I'm summarising a complicated situation very badly here. Scotland was basically being run by the Dukes of Albany, the Stuart family, and they were fine with the King of Scotland not being around, you know? Anyway, in time, James of Scotland went from being James the hostage being kept in the Tower of London to James the formal hostage, but not really, he was allowed to live in Windsor Castle, to James the bloody useful, who rode out to support Henry V in battles and later really messed with Scottish troops fighting for the French when they encountered English and Burgundian forces, which included their bloody king. And so now, under King Henry VI, the English decided it was time to, well, resolve the issue with James. Meanwhile, in 1423, several Scots, not all of them, but several, kind of wanted to bring their king back. And so the long process of negotiation for the ransom of James began. And this is why we start our story in 1424 in Southwark, because the English discovered a way for the Scottish king to be returned, but also in a way that was advantageous to the English throne, and where his ransom would not bankrupt the state of Scotland. The solution was to marry James into the English royal family. But of course this was not easy, as the royal family was not what it was. You had this small young king and he had no sisters. So it would have to be that James I of Scotland had to marry one of his cousins. All of which meant James I of Scotland married Jane Buford, the daughter of the late Duke of Exeter, and the niece of Bishop Buford, the Bishop of Winchester. As such, we start our story in Southwark, where on the 12th of February 1242, James and Jane married in the Church of St. Mary Overy, aka today's Southwark Cathedral, and followed this up by having a massive wedding feast at the nearby Winchester House, the huge Southwark-based palace of the bishop. And this celebration was, well, lavish and ornate, and crucially, improved the position of Bishop Buford politically. It also had the distinction of once again marking Southwark as his territory. The dowry for Jane Buford was supposedly 10,000 marks of silver, but the Buford dynasty didn't have to pay it. Rather, it was agreed that it would be written off, a remission on the king's ransom. And with this, James I returned to Scotland to try and restore royal authority up there. Of course, soon after this wedding, we had that standoff between the Duke of Gloucester and the Bishop of Winchester across London Bridge, which we mentioned last chapter. Which in turn led to the Duke of Bedford turning up and ordering both men to no longer have their followers stride around armed and growling at each other. But in the end, all that intervention did was leave the status quo, with the Duke of Gloucester in charge and the Bishop of Winchester facing greater resentment, especially in and around London. We know in 1426, Mayor John Coventry's term of office ended and he was replaced by the fishmonger, John Rainwell, a former alderman and twice one of London's MPs who would go on to be an MP two more times. And he oversaw the construction of a new drawbridge on London Bridge, ceremoniously laying the foundation stone. Now, the usual grisly adornments of the drawbridge tower, like the severed heads of traitors, were removed while the place was rebuilt, although the habit of decorating them with the heads of criminals was restarted once the drawbridge was remade. One has to ask, well, we know ongoing bridge repairs are a necessary thing for the maintenance of the London Bridge. How much did events of the year previously play into the decision to remake the drawbridge? The bridge had failed to provide an effective defence of London, dating all the way back to the Peasants' Revolt. Could it be that London decided to revitalise the old drawbridge to make it more effective as a barrier, so Southwark couldn't march up and kick the crap out of London and vice versa? Maybe. However, in 1428, the largest rebuilding project in London was started because of a fire. The all-new Baynard's Castle, the one constructed on the north bank of the River Thames after the erection of Blackfriars Priory, was suddenly consumed by flame and destroyed. It led to a new version of Baynard's Castle being ordered, and this was paid for and owned entirely by the Protector of England and the nation's chief noble and hero of London, Humphrey the Duke of Gloucester. But events elsewhere were about to impact on London, and the long story of the Bishop of Winchester was about to take some unusual twists. See, in 1426, after this standoff on London Bridge with the Duke of Gloucester, the political winds of fate seemed to shift against the Bishop of Winchester, and Beaufort responded by resigning the position of Chancellor of England. And at this point, Pope Martin V decided to make him a cardinal. Now, the Pope had tried to make Bishop Beaufort a cardinal once before. Significantly, the last time he resigned the post of Chancellor of England back in 1417. But back then, Henry V had said, no, you can't do it, as he wanted the bishop to remain working for him. But now in 1426, well, the Duke of Gloucester certainly wasn't going to say no. So the Bishop of Winchester sailed off from London to Rome, and there was dressed in cardinal red and ordained a leading prelate of the Roman Catholic Church. And Cardinal Beaufort immediately had a job to do for Pope Martin. In 1427, Henry Beaufort, Cardinal of the Church, was made the papal legate to Germany, Hungary, and Bohemia. This was a big thing, because right now Bohemia was by far the most important place in Europe in terms of warfare. Now, I know it would be easy to think it's France, as that's where the English forces are slowly eroding and overtaking the retreating forces of the Dauphin. But oh no, the fighting in Bohemia was way, way more important than this. And as such, we need to see why. And what follows is an utterly awful summary of events taking place over in Bohemia right now, as they're kind of important. Now, since this is a story of London and not the utterly epic story of Bohemia, I will return to London shortly. And please note, this brief account misses out loads of details. But over in the lands that would today include parts of Poland, the Czech and Slovak Republics, and parts of Hungary, that back then was all part of the Holy Roman Empire and was called the Kingdom of Bohemia, a reform movement started. And it was led by a man called Jan Hus. He was a Czech theologian and priest who began teaching at the University of Prague around about 1398. And as soon as 1399, he came into contact and rather liked the teachings of the Oxford theologian John Wycliffe. Hus resonated with Wycliffe's words. And despite the church authorities stating in England and then going elsewhere that Wycliffe's work should be banned, Jan Hus enthusiastically leapt upon the ideas of doctrinal and church reform he advocated. Hus embraced Wycliffe's words to empower his own, and from his own pulpit began to lambast the moral failings of the clergy, up to and including the papacy, and he did this with seeming impunity. His local bishop at first seemed to tolerate him, and it took orders from way on high to try to suppress the teachings of Wycliffe being found over in Prague. And there now follows a really convoluted series of internal politics about the elevation of who would be Holy Roman Emperor. And then that led to the Czechs getting more power in the University of Prague, which led German students leaving to set up their own university in Heidelberg, and Polish students setting up their own university in Leipzig. And then we had even more complications, as suddenly there are three popes all claiming to be legitimate popes. And in between all of this, Jan Hus continued preaching. It came to a head when one of the popes, when there were three popes, ordered a crusade upon the kingdom of Naples, who was supporting another pope, and he didn't like that. But and in order to pay for an armed force to march down and attack Naples, this pope decided to lean heavily into the sale of indulgences. That was a brilliant money-making project. You gave your local high-ranking member of the church a lot of money, and now he would formally ask God to forgive you of all your sins and issued you a lovely receipt for it. Jan Hus, influenced by John Wycliffe, saw this and called it out as bullshit. Tensions started to rise. And then came Sigismund. You may remember Sigismund. We mentioned him a few chapters ago. The Holy Roman Emperor-elect, turning up in London to try and negotiate peace between France and England. and how those peace talks were thrown out by the then Dauphin of France attacking English forces. And we left his story with him leaving London and returning to Europe. And in fact, he was returning to Europe to attend the Council of Constance, where he was desperate to try and solve the issues being caused by Jan Hus. See, by now, church authorities had really started to go after Jan Hus, and he was kind of retaliating. He quit his post in the university and took up preaching in Prague itself. And so they responded by placing the entire city under interdiction to prevent him from preaching, so then he'd moved out into the countryside. And when he was doing that, he began to realise that the work of John Wycliffe was good and all, but somewhat academic. So he decided he needed to start producing documents in language normal people spoke. And as such, Jan Hus's ideas grew and they were spreading all over Bohemia. This was becoming somewhat of a problem. And as such, Sigismund invited Hus to a council in Constance to defend himself. The reformer kind of knew he was walking into a trap as he made his will before he left, and there, eventually, after months of theological and legal shenanigans, Jan Hus was arrested, tried and condemned to death for heresy, being burned very slowly at the stake. And that's the end of the story, right? Nope, that's just the start. Because after this, Sigismund and the prevailing ruling cadre of nobility thought to tighten their grip on Prague and surrounding regions. And the followers of Jan Hus, the Hussites, rebelled, and fighting started, and didn't stop for quite some time. And this fighting caused a sensation across Europe. And the cause of this sensation was arguably one of the most amazing military leaders of this age, or any age. A Czech general called Jan Žižka. To be blunt, I'm simplifying this story. And in fact, the tale of the Hussites could be an entire podcast series all by itself. Žižka was a military genius who turned a ragtag bunch of rebels into one of the most devastating and powerful fighting forces in Europe, and did this by basically inventing what we would today happily call guerrilla warfare and asymmetric warfare. What made Žižka so important to military history was that he discovered that crossbows, and above all the crude primitive firearms his soldiers had looted from castles of the enemy, could be a total game changer. Armies involved big strapping men in armour and wielding swords and axes. But he worked out you could double the size of your army by placing firearms into the hands of weaker or older or younger men, or even women, and they could fire bullets that could cut down infantry and knights in good order. At the same time, he began to use transport carriages as wagon forts to stop enemy cavalry charges. He would place a body of big lads armed with normal weapons in front of these, and then reinforce these carriages with wood to prevent arrows getting at the people inside, and then fill the wagons with his people and firearms, where they'd fire one bullet in the gun and then hand it to a group of people behind them who'd reload it while handing them a second gun they could fire straight away, and so forth. The use of firearms and these war wagons were so successful that Žižka ordered the mass manufacturing of these war wagons following a universal template, and then he ordered the development of new types of firearms, using hard-learned experience on the battlefield to create a whole new generation of weapons. It's a bit like how today and how Ukraine has taken drone warfare and raised it to a whole new level. The Hussites did the same with firearms. And their influence we can see to this day. I mean, the name given to one particular type of handheld firearm developed and used by the Hussites in Czech, they called it a pistola, which we now know in English as a pistol. While the name for a heavy cannon designed to fire stone and iron against mass enemy forces of infantry on the battlefield was known as a hurfnis, which became known in English as a howitzer. These innovative tactics, these new weapons, this religiously inspired fanatical militia, the Hussites simply became the most devastating force in European warfare, even more than the English longbowmen. And under Žižka's inspired leadership, they simply did not lose. Battle after battle, Žižka never lost one. However, around this you have to add more convoluted tales of internal fighting between the Hussites and more, and the militia ended up operating far away as Poland and beyond. And ultimately, the Hussites just won and won and won. And the papacy was reduced to launching actual crusades against this rebellion. And they'd launched three. And they'd all ended in failure. And this is where we return to our London story right now, because the Bishop of Winchester, whose palace is situated in Southwark, close to St. Mary Overy, and whose current holder was the newly made Cardinal and Papal Legate, Henry Beaufort, was the man who the Pope sent to lead a fourth crusade against the Hussites. And believe it or not, they were actually optimistic about this fourth crusade, as the brilliant Jan Ziska had just died, and without him, it was believed, the crusader forces would finally break the heretics. Beaufort duly led and helped organise the forces that marched to take the battle against the Hussites, and it was in overall spiritual command of land forces, some of which he raised from Anglo-French forces, but most were German, and these were led by a man called Bosso of Vittium. And between them, they took 13,000 men towards the Hussite stronghold of Orsig, where the Hussites had about 11,000 men and maybe as many as 500 war wagons waiting for them. The Hussites drew up their wagons on one of the hills near the town in a series of circles. The Crusaders realized if you could break open the circles of war wagons, you could destroy the Hussites. And so they charged. And we're pretty sure the knights in that initial charge were armed with very large battle axes and hammers. We read of them hewing through the retaining chains of the wagons to breach through the barrier of wagons to get inside the circle. And the moment they did this, they found a second circle made up of crossbowmen behind wooden barriers, a unit known as pavaces. And so the knights charged them. But as they were fighting and smashing their way through, at the very heart of this circle of war wagons, there was cavalry belonging to the Hussites, and they had been waiting. And as the Crusaders attacked the second circle, perhaps it was just one last circle of wagons between them and the centre, the cavalry sneaked in behind the Crusaders. And at this, the Crusaders were suddenly surrounded, and the Hussites unleashed seven grace of hell upon them. A massive barrage of artillery fire, crossbow shots at close range, and endless handgun fire. And after pulverizing them like this, the Hussite cavalry charged in and slaughtered the lot of them. The battle had actually been brief, brutal, and bloody. 4,000 Crusaders in that initial attack had been slaughtered, and they'd been killed so brutally the rest of the army had fled. Cardinal Beaufort's crusade was over with just one blow. But this cardinal was not some weak-willed European Germanic type, oh no. He was off the Lancasterian family of the Plantagenet dynasty. This was a dynasty that had humbled the Valois of France. They were the most brutal fighting force in Europe. He was not giving up. He decided, rightio, first attempt failed. I'm going to regroup and go home. In September 1428, then, Cardinal Beaufort returned to England, but he was not greeted with any enthusiasm. This was down to two reasons. The first was the Duke of Gloucester had, you know, undermined his position when he was away, bad-mouthing the former Chancellor. But also, the problem was he was now a Cardinal. That made him the Pope's man, not the baby King's man. Many feared that him turning up would result in him advocating the cause and the power of the Pope. When he arrived back in England, Beaufort was met only by the Bishop of Salisbury and the Abbots of St. Albans and Waltham, and he promptly attempted to raise more funds in England for another Bohemian crusade. But because there was a war going on, no one wanted to offer any money, mainly because any money that was going to be spent was going to defend English lands in France. I mean, sure, the Hussites were heretics and everything, but priorities, man. And it was in the face of this that the Cardinal decided he would do something else. If he couldn't raise money, he would raise men. It was a crusade. Maybe he could find Englishmen willing to become crusaders. Now, this reappearance of his uncle in England, with his authority enhanced as cardinal and papal legate, rather threw Duke Humphrey, who had decided to preempt the cardinal by attacking him first in an attempt to deprive him of his basic source of his riches, the lucrative bishopric of Winchester, which he still held as well as being cardinal. Gloucester forced the young baby king to declare it with his own mouth in 1429 that his great uncle was suspended from exercising the bishop's office of chaplain to the Order of the Garter. And as well as that, with no financial help coming for the new crusade, coming from either the church or the royal council, the Duke of Gloucester also managed to half what was originally approved to be the size of crusaders that the cardinal could raise. And yet, the call of a crusade was still now, long after it had supposedly ended, a strong one. Buford still had his palace in Southwark. And somehow, he managed to raise a force of 250 English spearmen and around 2,000 English archers, the longbowmen whose reputation was feared across Europe. The English longbows had a greater rate of fire and a longer range than any firearm of the Hussites. While these weapons may not be suited for the war wagons, it was still a force to be reckoned with. This southern crusade from the Bishop of Winchester surprised everyone. The ruling council of England had actually recently issued a call for reinforcements to go help the Duke of Bedford in France. They'd only been able to raise a force smaller than this. Buford's crusading force was large and powerful. And at this point, I wonder, did any come from London? I have to say personally, I doubt it. We know from the standoff, the Bishop of Winchester's forces at London Bridge were mostly focused towards men of Lancashire and the north. But we also know from the regulations of Southwark Stews we covered a few chapters ago, the bishop did retain men and officers who worked for him in Southwark. So it could have been amidst those thousands of infantry and archers that men from Southwark found themselves getting ready to go off and fight a holy war in Bohemia. Now, once again, probably not, but we cannot completely discount the possibility, and therefore I've got to leave it raised that it may be happening. And we know for a fact that his preaching for forces to go on crusade against the Hussites did cause a response in London. We see records of people being arrested to be investigated for indulging in heretical thought. To be precise, the claim that no Christian should fight or kill the heretics of Bohemia. And in particular, we now look at the case of a London priest called Ralph Mungan. And he reveals a depth of feeling about this. One of Mungan's friends was Thomas Gartner, who was the chaplain of John Shadworth, who was an alderman and mercer. And he said these kind of views in front of an audience of important people from London, including Alderman William Estfield and John Russell, who was a leading mercer. Investigation was ordered into what Mungan actually said, and this was detailed at a session held in the Church of St. Michael Bassishaw by the Vicar General of London. This investigation involved Richard Colling, the Vicar of St. Lawrence Jury, Thomas Coleman, a chaplain from the nearby St. Alban Wood Street, and John Loveton and Thomas Cale, the priest and vicar of St. Michael Bassishaw, respectively. And it heard testimony of Mungan's heretical reputation. Ralph, a canon of Elsing Spittal and priest of St. Mary, Aldermanbury, then told a story which he presumably heard from Alderman William Estfield himself, that Mungan had also said that Christians should not fight or kill other Christians, heretics or not, but also that all property should be held in common. And this had taken place in February 1428 during a meal in Shadworth House, where Mungan's fellow priest, Gartner, was the chaplain. Immediately, these powerful men were brought in for questioning, and Estfield and Russell were duly examined in St. Paul's Chapter House on December 1428. And both agreed with the previous testimony and added that Mungan had also poured scorn on the idea of the Pope's indulgences. On the same day, Mungan refused at once to abjure these beliefs, and he was sentenced. And on Sunday, the 5th of December, two other priests, the chaplain we've mentioned, Thomas Gartner, and another priest called Richard Monk, did publicly abjure holding said beliefs. And this came after a sermon which condemned all these views, which was given at St. Paul's Cross, when all the leading citizens of London would have been present to hear it. You could well imagine that the households of the mercers and leading merchants of London could have spoken of little else. How there were people speaking against the sanctioned crusade due to sympathies for the Hussites. And even the powerful Alderman William Esfield may have felt a twinge of fear at the threatened retribution upon those who advocated those views. By the way, this scandal did nothing to prevent Esfield's elevation as mayor in 1429. But the case of Muggin and later Richard Monk showed that rather than just a throwaway moment from history in a nation far away, the events taking place in Bohemia, the Hussites and why they were fighting and what their cause stood for was not something that people felt distance from. There were people in London, a city that had been the hotbed for the followers of John Wycliffe, for whom the late Jan Hus had taken inspiration from, and who cared equally back for the fate of the Hussites. This world was a small place, smaller than we sometimes give credit for. But oddly enough, none of these crusaders, these thousands of men raised to go to war, ever actually made it to Bohemia. And why? Well, because events in England and France made it so they ended up going elsewhere. But to understand that, just need to explain what the hell's been going on back in England while our story's been romping across Bohemia. See, the Duke of Gloucester, who was Cardinal Beaufort out of the country, soon found himself getting into trouble for other reasons. In 1427, he attempted to make a last attempt to regain his wife's land in Holland, which we covered last chapter. And this time, he gained the support of the Earl of Salisbury, who would lead the forces this time, so he didn't get into a one-to-one fight with the Duke of Burgundy. But this second attempt was stopped dead in the water by the Duke of Bedford. And the Duke of Gloucester was finally induced to accept mediation to resolve the issue. AKA, he would not be claiming Hainault, Zeeland and Holland, it seemed. When Parliament opened that autumn, he decided to occupy himself by getting into a quarrel with the House of Lords over questions of them respecting his authority. But while this was going on, a separate scandal erupted. Apparently, so the rumours went, the Duke of Gloucester had basically abandoned his wife Jacqueline and was now openly shacked up with her principal lady-in-waiting, the Surrey-born Eleanor Cobham, who he'd brought back with him from Flanders. So great was this scandal that in 1428, a deputation of women from the stocks market and elsewhere presented a petition in Parliament against Gloucester's sinful wife. It is noticeable that these women being, quote, respectably apparelled, unquote, were apparently allowed to enter the House of Commons in person to deliver their petition. This is not a good look. Luckily, because of the confusion of her previous relationships back in Flanders, and because the papal dispensation to allow him to marry the Duchess of Holland had come from an anti-pope, the Duke of Gloucester was able to get the current pope, Martin V, to annul his marriage with Jacqueline, and therefore he could go on to marry Eleanor Cobham. This event didn't go down too well in London either, and we know there are records in London which show this. Quote, be it remembered that on the 8th of March, 1428, the mayor, aldermen and commonalty approached the lords spiritual and temporal and the commons of the realm in the parliament then held at Westminster, and by the mouth of John Simmond, the recorder of the city, declared the lamentable state to which the Lady Duchess of Gloucester, Countess of Hainault, Holland, etc., had been brought, and undeservedly so, plainly appeared from her sorrowful letters addressed to the said mayor and commonality. They therefore prayed the said lords and commons of the realm to take into consideration the manner in which the counties of Hainault, Holland, and Zeeland had ever been friendly to English merchants, and how the lady herself had been brought to England and honourably treated by the late king, and made godmother to the present king, and to grant her some relief and assistance, the petitioners themselves promising to assist in the matter as the said lords and commons might direct. And so, permission being granted, they withdrew, unquote. Yeah, in the opinion of the Londoners, she had tried to do right by London, and London's merchants and merchant adventurers did try to help the poor lady to a degree, whose usefulness to Prince Humphrey, being found expired, was seemingly seeing her dumped by the wayside. But while the Duke of Gloucester was busy shaking things up with a new mistress and having rows back in England about people doing exactly what he wanted, his older brother, the Duke of Bedford, was still happily busy jumping up and down upon the heads of the French after his magnificent victory over the Scots and Armagnac forces at the Battle of Verneuil in 1424. England had seemed to be on a roll. From that point, English France consisted of most of the Île-de-France, including Paris, and Normandy and Gascony. In addition to this, their Burgundian allies controlled Picardy and Champagne. The early acquisition of Maine and Anjou then also seemed imminent. And on the 10th of August 1425, Bedford took the capital of Maine, Le Mans. Yet another milestone seemed to have passed when in 1427, Duke John of Brittany decided to renounce his allegiance to the Dauphin Charles. English troops had penetrated to his capital, Reims, and they'd roundly defeated Charles' Breton constable Arthur of Richmond on the Breton marches. Meanwhile, there was also struggle between the constable and Charles's favourite back in the Dauphin's side, and fundamentally, the French were losing. And apart from a few temporary setbacks, Bedford, by 1427, seemed to be on the verge of executing the final great plan of conquest. He was about to capture the whole of Anjou and Maine and be able to link up with English Gascony. As Bedford himself later told his boy nephew the king, quote, "all things were prospered," unquote. England was winning, and it was clearly the Duke of Bedford's intention to advance into Argent. I mean, the Norman estates he was controlling voted taxation for this purpose in the summer of 1428. And then, suddenly, the invasion of Anjou was cancelled, and it was decided to attack Orléans instead. It seems most likely that this alternative plan was formulated in England, probably by Bedford's younger brother Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, in collusion with Thomas the Earl of Salisbury. And Thomas the Earl of Salisbury led 2,500 troops raised in England to join with 1,600 men of the garrisons and retinues in France in attempt to breach the Dauphin's Loire frontier. What this meant, however, that was for the first time since the death of Henry V, the Duke of Bedford had lost control of strategy in France. All previous reinforcements sent from England had been placed at his disposal. What was going on, basically, was politics, because while Bedford was technically in charge of both England and France, he could not hope to exercise the same authority as a king could. And quite simply, the gulf between the English in France and the English in England really began and was continuing to widen as the war went on, and this was one of those examples. And there were problems from the get-go about this attack on Orléans. The Duke of Orleans, or Orléans, was actually in captivity in England. He'd been captured during the Battle of Agincourt. And as such, technically, the invasion of his territories were against the chivalric code and against other agreements. This being said, an attack upon Orléans, it made sense. By inflicting a decisive blow against the Dauphin, his challenge to the north could be ended. Gloucester and Salisbury had, don't forget, been leading commanders under Henry V. Bedford's service had only really begun in 1421. It may well have been that they considered their policy to be closer to the wishes of the dead king than the rather conservative and, to them, excessively pro-Burgundian position of the Duke of Bedford. And so Salisbury marched his army to Orléans, a move the Duke of Bedford felt was, quote, "taken in hand God knoweth by what advice," unquote. The campaign started well, but that good start lasted less than a week, as only 4 days in, the Earl of Salisbury, prime mover in the change, was mortally wounded and went and died on the 3rd of November. The Duke of Bedford himself, for reasons not fully explained, and it could be pouting, never even came close to the siege. And we know by the 15th of April in 1429, he was getting seriously worried. He sent a letter back to England speaking of numerous desertions from Salisbury's army, voicing his misgivings about the outcome of the siege and asking for more reinforcements. The negotiations for the what hope was hoped to be the inevitable French surrender then faltered when basically the English had one idea of what to do with Orléans afterwards and the Burgundians had another, and the direct result was that Duke Philip of Burgundy managed to remove thousands of his soldiers from the siege. But it was still lingering on. But even if the siege of Orléans was going nowhere for the English, at that exact moment, the Dauphin's situation at his small court in Chinon was far more desperate. And at this point, having run through every available credible option open to him, he decides to consider an incredible one. He gave an audience to an illiterate 17-year-old farm girl called Jeanne, or Joan, who had turned up with the implausible story that she had been visited by saints who had told her that God wanted her to drive out the English and have the Dauphin crowned king at the Cathedral of Reims. Now, the Dauphin sent this young woman, who I'm going to just call Joan, to Poitiers to be examined by eminent theologians and members of his parliament. After that, he sent her to be checked out by the women of his court more intimately to verify she was, as she claimed, indeed a virgin. And this is important. You see, when she was young, apparently, a prophecy swept through the French countryside, supposedly based on the ecstatic visions of the reclusive Christian mystic Marie of Avignon, which promised that an armed virgin would come forth to save France. Of course, we have no record of the mystic Marie of Avignon actually having made such a prediction, so this could have been later BS added by theologians of the Dauphin to make the teenage girl look good. But be that as it may, 3 weeks later, the theologians and discreet women of the court reported that Joan appeared to be the genuine item. The theologians, by the way, did not verify that Saint Michael the Archangel and a couple of popular virgin female saints had appeared to her. They only said that she was not working for demonic influences, and the women pointed out the girl was intact and had never had sex before. The Dauphin therefore granted Joan's request to join a relief force he was sending to Orléans. Now, the siege, depleted as it was not watertight, and Joan and some of these forces managed to get into Orléans. And here, well, tradition says she was a military genius who was inspired by God to give insights to defeat the English. But by all accounts, her tactical understanding of warfare extended to the idea of just get stuck in and hit them. And while there are some extraordinary weaknesses to this idea of tactics, at Orléans, she was the right person at the right time, filling the Armagnac troops with the feeling that she was holy and mystical and actually cared for them, and badgering the local commanders into a series of quick attacks, during which they took the fortresses the English had erected around the city to enforce the siege, although one of them was technically already deserted by the English as they hadn't enough men. And finally, the English decided, sod this, and they left. Joan's amazing victory was sensational and an incredible morale booster for the French. And then she had added to it by advising the Armagnac military commanders that what they really needed to do right now was attack the English. Just attack. No, shut up. Just attack them. Get stuck in, you pansies. And so they did. William de la Pole, the Earl of Suffolk, the new commander appointed by Bedford, had raised the siege early in May and then dispersed his forces under several commanders and engaged in a tactical retreat. Unfortunately, he was then met by the Armagnacs, being led by this psychotic teenage girl, and found himself defeated and captured on the 20th of June, while several other commanders, including Falstaff, suffered a crushing humiliation at the Battle of Patay on the 18th of June. The result of all this was that the Dauphin of France was now moving towards the Cathedral of Reims to be appointed by the sacred oil of the ancient King Clovis, and designated King of France. From the verge of defeat to the symbolic gaining of coronation, the war against the English had just turned on a sixpence. And thus, the Duke of Bedford suddenly was getting rid of all nonsense. If England was going to stay in this war, it had to act now, and it had to act quickly. And thus, as he was wont to do, the Duke of Bedford responded with bold, decisive steps. And this is where we return to Southwark and the Bishop of Winchester. Henry Beaufort, Cardinal, had over 2,000 archers ready to march to Bohemia on crusade that he'd just recruited, and the Duke of Bedford needed them right now. And as such, he got Beaufort to basically end his career working for the Pope and get a foot back into English politics by convincing the Bishop and Cardinal to send his few thousand crusaders to serve Bedford in France, which had the positive effect of holding the line after so many losses and defeats. But the Duke of Bedford was not done. What he needed right now was for the boy Henry VI of England to match the coronation of the Dauphin with his own coronation. Henry VI had to be seen as the anointed King of France, not yesterday, but right this second. The problem, he had not even been anointed the King of England yet. So, in order to allow the kid be crowned King of France, he had to be crowned King of England in record time, and thus the apparatus of state and of London's pageantry kicked into gear at very short notice. Now, we know that young King Henry was still in the overall care of his mother in the spring of 1428, but new arrangements had to be made to take account of this sudden development. And by 1429, he was now, well, being pushed to become crowned king. And the date of his coronation was fixed upon the 6th of November, St. Leonard's Day. The streets of the city were adorned with much pageantry, as they always did during coronations. But this time, the spectacles were somewhat more moral in character. There were fountains of wine, as there had been at previous coronations. But these fountains were said to represent generosity, grace, and mercy, and they did not flow so much as trickle. One received a single cup of wine on discreet demand. Still, despite the moral overtones of the street celebrations, there were huge crowds, and the weather was fine. And so many people turned up that apparently a priest, a woman and several other persons were crushed to death. And it should be said that one writer of the festivities said that a heretic was burnt at Smithfield. Now, who this heretic was, we don't know. Apart from that one reference to it happening, we find no other records. Regardless, on St. Leonard's Day, Sunday the 6th of November 1429, Henry of Windsor, Henry VI, scarcely 8 years old, was taken in procession to the abbey ceremony of his coronation in the arms of his new tutor, the Earl of Warwick. But he did walk in unaided at the end of his coronation banquet between the bishops of Durham and Bath, with Warwick bearing his train. He had survived the grueling ceremony, the ceremonial washing and the creation of 32 Knights of the Bath the previous evening, then the morning procession from the tower to show himself to his people, followed by the solemn seating in the King's Bench in Westminster Hall, that full abbey ceremony, and finally the customary gargantuan banquet in the Westminster Hall with the typical dramatic appearance of the champion to defend his rights. But this Westminster coronation was but one half of a double ceremony for the hallowing of the King of Two Realms, who was as much an heir of St. Louis as he was an heir of St. Edward, of St. Denis, as well as St. George. Although the incredible splendour of the Westminster ceremonies bore no signs of hasty preparations, this had been done quickly. The young king set sail straight away to get to France, and he did not return to London until 1432. Yet even with the king gone, the great city carried on, always building and rebuilding. We know it was around now that the Carpenter's Hall was built. This grand headquarters of the Worshipful Company of Carpenters was located, as it is today, in the Throgmorton Avenue area. And the story goes that its extensive garden saved the building during the Great Fire of London, and the hall was used by several Lord Mayors during the rebuilding of their own mansions. Apparently, that's where the origin of the custom is, that the newly elected Lord Mayors of London dine first at Carpenter's Hall began. And we know that over in the Guildhall, the City Fathers decided that Guildhall's chapel was looking rather dowdy. I mean, it was already 150 years old and looked inadequate compared to the rest of the Guildhall buildings. This year, the city received a royal license to rebuild it. However, because this entire project was relying upon public funds and bequests, it did take 20 years for John Croxton's design to be erected. London moved forward, a passionate city in a passionate age. The fervour of religious beliefs we see here are not unique. It was part of the greater passion of the age. The Lollards and their Bohemian offspring, the Hussites, and the previous incarnation of radical Christian thought, the Cathars of France, spoke of a longing for a different type of Christian faith. And while neither the Lollards nor the Hussites ever really landed, they did sow the seeds for something much more profound. Something that would fundamentally change London forever. Something that's going to nail itself to the doors of a church in Wittenberg within the next century. But we'll come to that in time. Okay, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Gee, so much going on. I'll be back next week for another episode of The Story of London. Story of London exists due to listener contributions, and I'd like to thank all the people who've recently given us some really positive reviews and feedback on Spotify and on Apple Podcasts, and as well as that, the few brave and wonderful people who've just given us a few contributions via the Buy Me a Coffee webpage. And your contributions just allow us to cover hosting fees and things like that, and they are genuinely helpful. But if you can't do that, don't worry, we're just going to continue producing the podcast, and I've still got quite a while to go. So anyway, this is Saul, hoping you had a really good week, and I'll see you next week for another episode. Bye.